The U.S. Supreme Court has made recent rulings in the past decade that essentially say, especially Miller versus Alabama, aggregate life sentences for juvenile offenders amounting to a lifetime behind bars is unconstitutional. How revolutionary is this?
Well, it depends partly on who you ask. If we were in Europe, this would not be revolutionary at all. This is sort of standard practice. But in the United States, it really was part of a revolutionary trend to recognize that teenagers are not adults. They think and feel differently, and they should be a protected legal category. So there was a gradual process of protecting them from the death penalty, then protecting them from life without parole for non-murder offenses. And so the Miller versus Alabama case is sort of taking it the next step to protect them from mandatory life without parole sentences, even when they do commit murder.
What makes a juvenile offender's mind and reasoning different from that of an adult?
Well, the starting point is that human brains don't mature until the mid-20s. So in a sense, by definition, teenagers are not playing with a full deck, that their ability to think things through, to weigh risks and benefits, is impaired just by being an adolescent with an immature brain. And this extends to their ability to regulate their emotions, even to accurately perceive the emotions of others. So the Supreme Court recognized that for a variety of reasons, the developmental psychology of teenagers puts them at risk for impulsive behavior, for the influence of peers and older individuals, for being affected by their adverse family and community situations, and even being limited in their ability to function in their own defense when it gets to the legal process. So for all these reasons, these five factors that are often called sort of the Miller factors, the court recognized that teenagers should be treated differently, held accountable, but not in the same way that adults might be held accountable.
There is a case, of course, that is now being weighed for possible direction to the U.S. Supreme Court involving Kip Kinkle. Do you feel that, given the recent Supreme Court arguments and rulings, that there is a potential for Mr. Kinkle to be released ahead of his 112-year sentence someday?
Well, certainly my hope for Kip and others around the country is that the courts will recognize that these draconian sentences, these some call them Methuselah sentences, because they're technically not given as, you know, death in prison sentences, but they really are. No one is going to survive a 100-year sentence. All around the country, there are kids in that situation, and I think the next logical step is to bring some different perspective to them and their situation. And so I really do have a hope that there'll be progress in an understanding that these teenagers committed crimes, often horrible crimes, but the developmental science of it says that these crimes themselves do not predict the possibilities for rehabilitation and transformation on the part of these teenagers. That in fact their crimes, which are very significant morally and legally, don't really have much predictive value in thinking about who they can and will become in the future. And that's one reason why we need to rethink the way we sentence them and the way we assess them as the years go by.
You said early on in the interview, Doctor, that Europe has a very different attitude towards juvenile offenders than the American justice system. Why do you think there's a difference there?
Well, the European countries in many ways have been more responsive to human rights issues, to the implications of scientific research. So, for example, in Norway, the maximum sentence for any crime is 21 years. And I think from my research and the research of others, there's a good case to be made that 20 years is about the right time. If you commit a murder as a teenager, you have 10 years roughly until you have a mature brain. And often their behavior is erratic or disobedient or aggressive during that period because they're still not fully equipped. But then what you often find is in the mid-20s, they begin to use that mature brain for education, for therapeutic change, for transformation, for spiritual development. And 10 years later, they emerge as very safe individuals in fact, often more than just safe, extraordinary individuals who've gone through the fire of this terrible thing that they did and the consequences of it, and they emerge as just remarkable people. I think the Europeans have been more ready to recognize that. Generally, they have a more, what you might call, progressive or informed or enlightened view of this. You think of something like the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which has been ratified by almost every country in the world, certainly all of the European countries. The United States is one of the few countries, one of a tiny number of countries who hasn't ratified it. In fact, in the Supreme Court decisions in Miller versus Alabama, some of the justices who voted against that decision said, in effect, why do we need to listen to the rest of the world? We're America. We don't go by these international standards.
When you look at some of the crimes that juveniles have committed, very horrific crimes, as you said, there is obviously a very strong response to the possibility that these offenders might be re-released back into society. Fear and resentment being a very natural response. How does one reintegrate a juvenile offender, particularly one who's committed a severely violent act, back into society successfully?
Well, the question of reentry or reintegration is certainly a big one. Most of the guys that I know, I have known, there's a lot of time and effort and energy spent in planning reentry, transitional arrangements, support systems to help them make that transition, because often, you know, these are guys who went to prison at 16, they didn't even have a driver's license, never had a checking account, and now they're 36 or 40 and they're sort of starting from scratch. Even reading a menu, it can be a challenge. So there is a need to help them make that transition. To the best of my knowledge, not one of the individuals released under the Miller resentencing has committed another crime. It's not a large number yet, but the prognosis is very good for their reintegration. It may be difficult to reintegrate into the community in which they committed the crime because there's lingering trauma, there's still anger, there's still hurt in the families of the victims, and that may be a reason to locate somewhere different to both avoid that conflict, but also to not sort of rub salt into the wound of victims' families that are still suffering. I should say, though, that research, I think, is becoming quite clear that for victims to engage in the process of forgiveness ultimately is in their benefit. Because if you don't find a way to engage in forgiveness, it's bad for your health, it's bad for your state of mind. Holding on to that hurt and anger and rage is not good for you as a victim's family member. So there's a sort of a win-win situation here, I think, that when this process occurs smoothly for everyone, the whole community benefits.
How do you want your research and your writings to be used going forward? Is there a particular audience and a particular outcome that you want to see for it?
Well, I would like to see the community be educated about the realities of these transformations and rehabilitations. Often people have a very stereotyped view. They may have been aware of a crime when it happened at 16, and they're sort of frozen in time, and they don't see the change that occurs. The often Herculean efforts that are made by offenders to make their lives worthwhile, knowing that they took a life or multiple lives. So I think that's important because judges have to make these decisions, and they often exist in a political climate where they're afraid of voter retribution or public retribution if they recognize someone has transformed and rehabilitated and let them out. They're worried about critics coming after them for that. And that has been one of the major impediments, I think, in this whole process, that judges are afraid to do the right thing for these guys because they fear retribution in the political environment. And so that requires not just telling them to be braver, but also requires the community to understand more, and so not exact retribution against judges who see the science, who see the developmental progress.
Certainly no one wants to be the judge who re-releases an offender back into the community and then something terrible happens again. But for the people that you've seen released following the Supreme Court rulings, Have you seen them be able to integrate themselves back into society in a meaningful and satisfying way for themselves?
To the best of my knowledge, and it's not, of course, complete, the transition has been successful for guys released under these Miller resentencing because, you know, typically they've spent 20 years working on themselves, and then they may spend several years preparing to be released. And so all the pieces of a supportive puzzle are in place for them. And so I'm pretty confident that these guys will continue to be successful. Again, it's not a large number of people released already, and they haven't been out for a long time, but every piece of evidence I've seen has been very encouraging on that.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.